that saves us, Hassler said, that puts us back on top of the food chain. This valley is the only place where we can survive. We're going to become extinct. That's simply a fact. Might as well do it with grace. Savor each day. Each moment. Mustin. Mustin brushed the snow off the rocks and settled down into his perch. Due to the sheer quantity of ammo he'd brought along this time, it had taken him an extra hour to reach the peak. He'd scoped the town before, but of course, he'd never had a target in the valley. He zeroed out the scope on what was left of Sheriff Burke's Bronco. It took him 3 shots, followed by the 3 minor adjustments to the parallax, before he put a round exactly where he wanted it, through the front tire on the driver's side. The town had been laid out in regular blocks, 300 feet long on each side, which meant that further adjustments would be simple now that he had his point of reference. He cracked his neck. Grabbing the bolt, he opened the breech and jacked the first round out of the 5-capacity magazine. Settling in behind the focus, he enabled his headset as he glassed to Main Street.
"Mustin here. In position. Over."
Ethan Burke responded, "We're at the tunnel door. Over."
"Copy that. Beginning my first pass now. Stand by. Out."
There were bodies scattered up and down Main. 5 Abbeys feeding in the middle of the street in front of the steaming bean. For now, he ignored the forest and the cliffs surrounding the town and took his time studying the east-west running avenues, the north-south running streets. He scribbled a notation on his pad after every sighting. 11 minutes later, he tapped the talk function on his headset.
"Mustin back. Over."
"Go ahead," Ethan said.
"I've got a visual on 105 aberrations. About half of them are moving in groups of between 15 and 20. The others are ranging solo through town. No sign of survivors yet."
Ethan said, "You've got 20 minutes, and then we're rolling in. Over." Mustin smiled. A deadline. He liked that. He asked,
"We taking bets? Over."
"What are you talking about?"
"Number of kills. Over."
"Just get to it." Mustin started on the south end of Maine and worked slowly north. 15 hits, 5 misses, 12 kills. 3 left to wish they were dead, dragging themselves across the pavement. He moved up to 7th Street, made his adjustments, and went to work. Near the school, he sighted down a group of 18 Abbeys sleeping in the street. He shot 4 of them before the others woke up and realized they were under attack. Brought down 5 more as they scattered. It went on like this, and he had to admit it was the most fun he'd ever had with his AWM sniper rifle. With 5 minutes remaining, he shot 3 Abbeys on the road south of town, killed 2 more in the vicinity of the gardens. As the sheriff's voice came back over the headset, he put a round through the head of an Abbey running at full speed past the hospital.
"Time's up," Ethan said. "Over."
44, Mustin said. "Over."
"Excuse me?"
"There are 44 less Abbeys to contend with. Over."
"Impressive.
Is the fence holding?" Mustin swung the rifle south, glassing the forest in the vicinity of the fence. He reported,
"The gate's still closed. Now, I can give you some cover once you get into town, but shooting down into the forest is iffy at best. Over."
"Understood. You'll be our eyes. Kill what you can. Tell us what's coming. Over." Mustin reloaded the magazine and chambered the next round. He glassed what he could see of the woods and the boulders that surrounded the entrance to the superstructure.
"You're clear to roll out," he said.
Ethan. He rode in the front passenger seat of an armored Humvee with Alan behind the wheel. In his side mirror, he could see the metal workers welding shut the entrance to the superstructure. Up on the roof of the Humvee, one of the guards manned a .50-caliber machine gun. There were 2 Dodge Ram pickup trucks behind them, 2 men standing in the back of the first with pump-action shotguns. The second Ram carried the chain gun. 2 transfer trucks followed the Rams, and a third pickup truck brought up the rear, holding 6 guards in the bed, all armed to the teeth. In Ethan's headset, Mustin said, "I'd advise staying off Main. What's your route, over?" Alan turned out of the woods and onto the road into town. 13th to 5th, Ethan said. "Then 3 blocks to the school. Any company?" "See that guy in the distance?" Ethan squinted through the windshield. 100 yards up the road, an Abbey was squatting over the double yellow. The sound of approaching engines caught its attention, and as it stood, a puff of red mist exploded out of the side of its head. "You got a few other stragglers in your path," Mustin said. "I'll start clearing the way, over." The sun had yet to rise above the cliffs, and the valley ahead was still draped in the light of early morning. "Get any sleep?" Alan asked. "And what do you think?" Kate. She heard the tat-tat-tat of automatic gunfire. Everyone in the classroom did. She and Spitz went to work dragging the furniture away from the door and pulling the nails out of the frame. They got it open, told everyone to wait, rushed out into the hall, up the stairs. The noise of gunfire growing louder, and in the space between shots another sound becoming audible, the rumble of engines. At the exit, Kate raised her AR-15 and told Spitz to get the door. He pulled it open. She took 2 steps through the threshold. There were Abbeys in the schoolyard, running toward a convoy of vehicles in the intersection of 10th and 5th, a Humvee, 3 pickup trucks, and 2 18-wheelers. An Abbey broke off from the pack and came hurtling toward her. Spitz said, "You got him?" She let it get closer, within 20 feet.
"Kate!"
She squeezed, put 3 bursts in a nice pattern through its chest, and dropped it 5 feet from the door. Now came a noise like thunder, and with it, from the second pickup truck, a bright orange muzzle flash from a gun so big it should have been mounted on an attack helicopter. It cut an entire row of Abbeys in half. The front passenger door of the Humvee swung open. When Ethan stepped out, her heart swelled. She watched him come around the front of the vehicle and run toward the fence. As he climbed over, 4 Abbeys charged him from the playground. Kate took aim and ripped through the rest of her magazine, bringing them all down. Ethan looked over, eyebrows up in surprise. For a moment, the shooting had stopped. There were Abbeys lying everywhere, and men climbing down out of the truck beds, beginning to set up a perimeter. Kate ran toward him, Ethan limping, carrying a shotgun, his jeans ripped all to hell, his shirt in tatters, face streaked with blood. Tears blurred her vision, and she wiped them away. They reached each other, and she threw her arms around him. "How are the injured?" he asked. "One died. One's hanging on. Barely. I brought trucks. We're taking everyone out of here, into the mountain." "Have you found Harold?"
"Not yet."
"What about Teresa and Ben?"
He shook his head.
Tears were running down her face, and her eyes were shut tight, and Ethan kept saying her name, kept saying that everything would be okay. But she couldn't stop crying, and she wouldn't let him go.
Ethan. As he held Kate, he glimpsed a man walking down 10th Street in a long black duster that fell to his ankles, his face hidden under a black cowboy hat and a long, unkempt beard. Ethan said, "Who the hell is that?" Kate turned her head.
"I've never seen him before."
Ethan started across the schoolyard, scaled the fence, and moved out into the middle of the street. The man in black carried a Winchester rifle, which rested against his shoulder, and his shuffling gait scraped his boots across the pavement. He stopped several feet away from Ethan, a haggard, vile-smelling specimen. He would have looked like a homeless eccentric were it not for his eyes. No insanity there, just clear, lucid intensity. The man said,
"Well, goddamn, Ethan."
"I'm sorry. Do we know each other?"
Ethan just glimpsed the man's smile through the shambles of his beard.
"Do we know each other?"
The man laughed, his voice scratchy, like his larynx had been wrapped in sandpaper.
"I'll give you a hint. Last time we spoke, I sent you here.
Recognition fired in Ethan's brain, synapses connecting the dots. He cocked his head and said,
Adam? So what I hear, you started this mess.
You've been in town all this time?
No, no. I just got back.
Back from where?
Out there. Beyond.
You're a nomad.
I've been gone 3.5 years. Came back through the fence yesterday at dawn.
Adam,
I know you have questions, but if you're looking for your family, I found them last night.
Where?
Teresa had locked herself and Ben into the jail cell in the sheriff's station.
They're there right now?
Yes, and...
Ethan took off running up 10th Street, maintained a full sprint for 6 blocks until he rushed into the sheriff's station, gasping for breath.
Teresa! He shouted. Ethan?
He shot down the hallway toward the cell at the north end of the building, and when he saw his wife and son alive behind the bars, his eyes filled with tears. Teresa fumbled with the keys, turned the lock. Ethan pushed the door open and embraced her, kissing her face, her hands, like it was the first time he'd ever touched her.
I thought I'd lost you. You almost did.
Ben nearly tackled him.
You okay, buddy?
Yeah, Dad, but we almost died.
Gunshots started up again, several blocks away.
You brought the cavalry, Teresa said.
I did.
Have you rescued a lot of people?
There's a group in the basement of the school that's going to be okay.
A security team is fanning out through the town now, killing everything that isn't human, saving whoever else they can.
Why didn't you and Ben stay in the cavern?
The Abbeys came back, Ben said. A lot of people stayed, but Mom and I found another way down the cliffs.
Those who stayed? I don't think they made it, Teresa said.
Through the bars, Ethan noticed Pam, dead on the floor.
She found us here last night, Teresa said. We were locked in the cell with no weapons. She was going to kill us.
Why?
To hurt you.
Teresa seemed to shudder at the memory of it.
Adam Hassler saved us, she said.
Did you know he was here? Ethan asked.
No.
The chain gun started up again. Ethan pulled out his radio and said, Burke here, over. Alan's voice responded,
Yeah, go ahead, over.
Can you send a truck up to the sheriff's station? I found my family. I want to get them someplace safe. 8. Teresa, Wayward Pines, 5 years ago. She stands in the rain, barefoot, her hospital gown soaked straight through to her skin, staring up at a 25-foot fence whose barbed wires crackle with electricity. 2 signs nearby warn, High voltage, risk of death, and Return to Wayward Pines, beyond this point you will die. She crumples down in the dirt, cold, shivering. It's dusk, on the verge of becoming too dark to see in these woods. She's at the end, at her end. No one to turn to, nowhere left to run. She crashes, hard, sobbing uncontrollably as the freezing rain beats down on her. Hands grab her by the shoulders. She reacts like a wounded animal, tearing herself away and scrambling off on all fours as a voice calls after her, Teresa! But she doesn't stop. Struggling up onto her feet, she digs in for a sprint, feet sliding in the wet pine needles. The hands tackle her to the ground, her face crushed into mud, pressing down on top of her and trying to roll her over. She fights back with everything she has, arms tucked into her sides, thinking, if those hands get anywhere near my mouth, this asshole is going to lose fingers. But he manages to roll her onto her back and hold her arms down, pinning her legs under his knees.
Let go!
She screams.
Stop fighting!
That voice. She looks up at her attacker. It's almost too dark to see now, but she recognizes his face. From another life. A better time. She stops struggling.
Adam?
It's me.
He releases her arms and helps her to sit up.
What are you? Why?
So many questions screaming through her mind, she can't focus on which one to give voice to. At last, she lands on,
What's happening to me?
You're in Wayward Pines, Idaho.
I know that. Why is there no road out of here? Why is there a fence? Why won't anyone tell me what's happening?
I know you have questions.
Where's my son?
I may be able to help you find Ben.
You know where he is?
No, but I...
Where is he?
She screams.
I have to...
Teresa, you're endangering yourself right now. You're putting both of our lives at risk. I want you to come with me.
Where?
To my house.
Your house?
He takes off his rain jacket, wraps it around her shoulders, and pulls her up onto her feet.
Why do you have a house here, Adam?
Because I live here.
For how long?
A year and a half.
That's impossible.
I know it must feel that way to you right now. I'm sure everything seems strange and wrong in this moment. Where are your shoes?
I don't know.
I'm going to carry you.
Hassler scoops her up into his arms like she weighs nothing. Teresa looks into his face, and despite the horror of her last 5 days here, she can't deny the comfort she feels staring into familiar eyes.
Why are you here, Adam?
I know you have a lot of questions. Let me just get you home first, okay? You're practically hypothermic.
Have I lost my mind? I don't know anything anymore. I woke up in the hospital here, and these last few days have been...
Look at me. You are not crazy, Teresa.
Then what?
You're just in a different kind of place now.
I don't know what that means.
I know, but if you trust me, I swear I'll take care of you. I'll make sure nothing happens to you, and I'll help you find your son.
Despite the new protection of his jacket, she trembles violently in Hassler's arms. He carries her through the dark forest and the pouring rain. Her last memory before waking in this town is of sitting in her home in Queen Anne, across from a man named David Pilcher. It was the night she'd thrown a party to celebrate her missing husband's life, and after all the guests had left, Pilcher had shown up on her doorstep in the wee hours with a mysterious offer. Come with him, and she and Ben could be reunited with Ethan. Apparently, the promise had not been kept. Teresa lies on a sofa pulled close to an open wood stove, watching as Adam Hassler adds pine logs to the fire. The deep-down cold is beginning to retreat from her bones. She hasn't slept in 48 hours since waking up for a second time in a hospital bed to that awful, smiling nurse, but now she can feel sleep stalking her. She won't be able to hold out much longer. Hassler stokes the flames up into a roaring blaze, the sap boiling and popping inside the wood. Every light in the living room is out. Firelight colors the walls. She can hear the steady rain hammering the tin roof above her head, ready to put her under. Hassler scoots back from the fire, sits on the sofa's edge. He looks down at her with a kindness in his eyes that she hasn't seen in days.
"Is there anything I can get for you?"
he asks.
"Water? More blankets?"
"I'm okay. Well, not okay, but..."
He smiles.
"I know what you mean."
She stares up at him.
"These have been the weirdest, worst days of my life."
"I know."
"What's happening to me?"
"I can't explain it to you."
"Can't? Or won't?"
"You disappeared from Seattle the night of Ethan's celebration of life party. You and Ben."
"Right."
"I figured you had gone to Wayward Pines looking for Ethan, so I went looking for you."
"Shit. You're here because of me."
"I drove into town 2 days before Christmas. All I remember is a Mack truck coming out of nowhere, sideswiping my car. I woke up in the hospital just like you did. No phone, no wallet. Have you tried to call out to Seattle?"
"I phoned my sister Darla, I don't know how many times from that payphone beside the bank, but it's always either a wrong number or there's no dial tone."
"Same thing happened to me."
"So how do you have a house here now?"
"I have a job, too."
"What?"
"You're looking at the sous chef in training at the Aspen House,
Nicest restaurant in Wayward Pines. Teresa searches his face for signs of bullshit, but he looks absolutely sincere. She says, You're the special agent in charge of the Secret Service field office in Seattle. You...
Things have changed.
Adam,
just listen to me.
He puts his hand on her shoulder. She can feel its weight through the blanket.
All the questions, all the fears you have, I have them too. I still have them. That doesn't change. But there are no answers to be had in this valley. There's only a right way to live, and all the other ways that get you killed. As your friend, Teresa, I hope you can hear me. If you don't stop running, this town will murder you.
She looks away from Hassler into the flames, the firelight blurring through a sheet of tears. The scary thing, the truly scary thing, is that she believes him. 100%. There's something wrong, something evil about this place.
I feel so lost, she says.
I know. He squeezes her shoulder. I've been there, and I'm going to help you in every way I possibly can.
Ethan.
He found Kate that evening, sitting in her living room, staring into the cold, dark fireplace. He sat down beside her, set his shotgun on the hardwood floor. Abby's had broken in at some point. The front windows were smashed out, the interior looked vandalized, and it still smelled like those creatures, a harsh alien stench.
What are you doing in here? Ethan asked.
Kate shrugged.
I guess I feel like if I wait here long enough, he'll come walking through that door.
Ethan put his arm around her. She said,
But he's not going to walk through that door ever again, is he?
It seemed as if it was only by sheer force of will that she held the tears back. Ethan shook his head.
Because you found him.
The light splintering through the busted windows was growing weaker by the moment. Soon it would be dark in the valley.
His group was run down in one of the tunnels, Ethan said.
Still no tears came. She just breathed in and out.
I want to see him, she said.
Of course. We've been gathering up the dead all day, doing what we can to prepare them for...
I'm not afraid to see him torn up, Ethan. I just want to see him.
Okay.
How many did we lose?
We're still recovering bodies, so right now we're only counting survivors. Out of 461 in-town residents, we're down to 108. 75 are still unaccounted for.
I'm glad it was you who came with this news, she said.
They're bringing all the survivors into the mountain for the next few nights.
I'm staying right here.
It's not safe, Kate. There are still abbeys in the valley. We haven't gotten them all. There's no power, no heat. When the sun drops, it's going to get very dark and very cold. The abbey still inside the fence will come back into town.
She looked at him. She said, I don't care.
You want me to sit with you for a while?
I want to be alone.
Ethan rose to his feet, every inch of his body sore, bruised, done.
I'll leave this shotgun with you, he said, just in case.
He couldn't be sure that she'd heard him. She was utterly elsewhere.
Is your family safe? Kate asked.
They are. She nodded. I'll come back in the morning, he said. Take you to see Harold. He moved toward the front door. Kate said,
Hey.
He looked back.
This isn't your fault.
That night, Ethan lay next to Teresa in a warm, dark room, deep inside the superstructure. Ben slept on a rollaway at the foot of their bed, the boy snoring quietly. The nightlight across the room put out a soft blue, and Ethan stared into the glow. The first night in ages he could actually sleep in warmth, in safety, without a camera spying on him. Sleep was there for the taking, but he couldn't find his way in. Teresa's hand moved around his side and across his stomach. She whispered, "You awake?" He rolled over to face her, and by the illumination of the nightlight, saw the glistening in her eyes, the wetness on her face.
"I need to tell you something," she said.
"Okay."
"You've only been back in our lives for barely a month."
"Right."
"We'd already been here for 5 years. We didn't know where we were, if we were."
"I already know all this."
"What I'm trying to say is, there was someone before you came."
"Someone," Ethan said, a sudden pressure building in his chest, a weight pressing down on his lungs, stopping him from drawing a full breath.
"I thought you were dead, or that maybe I was."
"Who?"
"When I first came to town, I didn't know a soul. I woke up here just like you did, and Ben wasn't with me, and—"
"Who?"
"You saw that Adam Hassler is here."
"Hassler?"
"He saved my life, Ethan. He helped me find Ben."
"Are you for real?" She was crying now.
"I lived with him in that house on 6th Street for over a year, up until the day he was sent away."
"You were with Hassler?" A sob caught in her throat.
"I thought you were dead. You know how this town can mess with you."
"Did you share his bed?"
"Ethan."
"Did you?" She nodded. He rolled away from her onto his back and stared at the ceiling, no idea how to even begin to process this. All he had were questions, images of Hassler and his wife, and a raw, combustive pool of confusion, anger, and fear coalescing deep inside of him that was accelerating toward supernova.
"Talk to me," she said. "Don't shut down."
"Were you in love with him?"
"Yes."
"Are you still?"
"I'm confused."
"That's not a no."
"Do you want me to protect your feelings, Ethan, or do you want me to be honest?"
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because I wasn't prepared to have this conversation. You'd only been here a month. We were just starting to reconnect again."
"You never were. Your lover showed up out of nowhere and forced your hand."
"This is not true, Ethan. I swear I would have told you. I was assured that Adam was never coming back. And by the way, I was with Hassler when I thought you were dead. You fucked Kate Hewson while I was still very much alive. While I was your wife. So let's keep this shit in perspective, shall we?"
"Do you want to be with him?"
"If he hadn't found me, I would have kept running and running until they murdered me. There is no doubt in my mind. He supported me. He took care of me when there was no one else to do it. When you weren't around."
Ethan turned back onto his side and faced his wife, their noses touching, her breath in his face, and a roiling mass of emotion inside of him that he wasn't completely certain he could keep tied down. "Do you want to be with him?" he asked again.
"I don't know."
"You don't know? That doesn't mean maybe?"
"I have never been loved the way that man loves me."
Ethan stopped breathing.
"If it's hard for you to hear, I'm sorry, but I was his world, Ethan, and it—"
She let the words go, let them trail off into nothing. "What?"
"I shouldn't say any—"
"No, finish your thought."
"It was like nothing I'd ever experienced. Since the first time you and I met, I have loved you with everything I have. Can I just be straight up with you? I have always loved you. More than you loved me."
"That is not true."
"You know it is. My loyalty, my devotion to you has been total. If our marriage was a rope, you on one end, me on the other, I was always pulling a little bit harder, and sometimes a lot."
"This is punishment, isn't it? For Kate."
"Not everything is about you. This is about me and this man I fell in love with while you were gone, and who's now back, and I have no fucking idea how to handle it. Can you put yourself in my shoes for 2 seconds?
Ethan sat up in bed, threw back the covers. Don't leave, she said. I just need some air.
I shouldn't have told you.
No, you should have told me on day one. He climbed out of bed, walked in socks, pajama bottoms, and a wife beater out of their room. It was late, 2 or 3 a.m., and level 4 stood empty, the fluorescent lights humming quietly overhead. Ethan walked down the corridor. Behind every door he passed, residents of Wayward Pines slept safe and sound. There was comfort in knowing that some had been saved. The cafeteria was closed, dark. Stopping at the doors to the gymnasium, he peered through the glass. In the low light, he saw the raised basketball hoops, the court covered in cots. The people in the mountain had volunteered as a group to give up their rooms on level 4 to the refugees, a gesture he hoped would be a good omen for the tough transition to come. Down on level 2, he swiped his card and stepped into surveillance. Alan sat at the console, watching the screens. He looked back as Ethan entered and said,
"You're up late."
Ethan took a seat beside him. "Anything?" he asked. "I disabled the motion sensors that powered up the cameras, so they're running all the time now. I'm sure the batteries won't last much longer. I've spotted a few dozen Abbeys back in town. I'll take a team down in the morning, first thing, to finish them off."
"And the fence?"
"Full power. All levels in the green.
You should really get some sleep."
"I don't see a lot of that in my future."
Alan laughed. "Tell me about it."
"Thank you, by the way," Ethan said. "If you hadn't backed me up yesterday..."
"You honored my friend."
"The people from town..."
"Don't let this out, but we call them townies."
Ethan said, "They're going to be looking to me. I have a feeling the people in the mountain will be looking to you."
"Looks that way. There's going to be some tough choices to make in our future, and a right way and a wrong way to handle them."
"What do you mean?"
"Pilcher ran things a certain way."
"Yeah, his."
"I'm not defending the man, but sometimes situations arise which are so pivotal, so life and death, one or two strong people need to call the shots."
"Think Pilcher has any diehards in the mountain?" Ethan asked.
"What do you mean? True believers?"
"Exactly."
"Everyone in this mountain is a true believer. Don't you understand what we gave up to be here?"
"No."
"Everything. We believed that man when he said the old world was dying and that we had a chance to be a part of the new world to come. I sold my house, my cars, cashed out my 401k, left my family. I gave him everything I had."
"Can I ask you something?"
"Sure."
"You might have missed it with all the other excitement, but we had a nomad return today."
"Yeah, Adam Hassler."
"So you know him?"
"Not well. I'm shocked he made it back."
"I'd like to know more about him. Was he a townie before he left on his mission?"
"I couldn't tell you." "You should go talk to Francis Levin."
"Who's that?"
"The steward of the superstructure."
"Which means..."
"He tracks supplies, system integrity, the status of people in suspension and out. He's a wealth of institutional memory. The heads of each group report to him, and he reports, well, reported to Pilcher."
"Never met him."
"He's a recluse, keeps mostly to himself."
"Where would I find him?"
"His office is tucked way back in the Ark."
Ethan stood. The pain meds were fading.
The wear and tear of the last 48 hours becoming suddenly pronounced. As Ethan started out toward the door, Alan said,
"One last thing."
"Yeah?"
"We finally found Ted. He was in his room, stuffed in his closet, stabbed to death. Pilcher had cut his microchip out and destroyed it."
Ethan would have thought that after a day like this, one more piece of shitty news would crash into his psyche like a wave against a seawall. But it penetrated. Deep. He left Alan and went back out into the corridor, started up the steps toward level 4 dormitories, but then stopped. Turning back, he descended the last flight of stairs to the first level. Margaret, the Abbey whose intelligence Pilcher had been testing for the last few months, was up, pacing in her cage under the glare of the fluorescence. Ethan put his face to the small window and stared through, his breath fogging the glass. Last time he'd seen this Abbey, she'd been sitting peacefully in the corner, docile, human-like. Now she looked agitated, not angry, not vicious, just nervous. "Because so many of your brothers and sisters have come into our valley?" Ethan wondered. "Because so many have been killed, even in this complex." Pilcher had told him that the Abbeys communicated through pheromones, used them like words, he said. Margaret saw Ethan. She crept on all fours, over toward the door, and stood on her hind legs. Ethan's eyes and the Abbey's eyes were just inches away, separated by the glass. Up close, hers were almost pretty. Ethan moved deeper into the corridor. Six doors down, he looked through the window of another cage. There was no bed, no chair. Just a floor and walls and David Pilcher sitting in a corner, his head hung as if he'd fallen asleep sitting up. The lights burned down through the window and lit the left side of the man's face. He hadn't been allowed to keep any personal effects, including a razor, and white stubble was beginning to overspread his jaw. "You did this," Ethan thought. "You ruined so many lives. My life. My marriage." If he'd had a key card to this cell, Ethan would have rushed inside and beat the man to death. Everyone, townies and mountain people, came down for the burials. The cemetery was too full to accommodate all the bodies, so an open field on the southern border of the graveyard was annexed. Ethan helped Kate with Harold. The sky was gray. No one spoke. Tiny flakes of snow swirled through the crowd. There was just the constant sound of shovel heads stabbing into the cold, hard ground. As the digging finished, people crumpled down in the snow-frosted grass beside loved ones, or what was left of them, the dead wrapped tightly in once white sheets. The digging had given them something to do, but as they sat motionless and cold beside lost fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, friends, and children, muffled sobs began to rise up from the crowd. Ethan walked out into the middle of the field. From where he stood, it was a crushing collection of sights and sounds. All those little mounds of dirt, the dead waiting to be lowered into their final resting places, the grieving of those who had lost everything, the mountain people standing behind the townies looking solemnly on, and the column of smoke at the north end of town coughing spirals of sweet-smelling black into the sky as 600 Abbey corpses smoldered into nothing. Except for David Pilcher, the man responsible for all this pain, every human being left on Earth was in this field. Even Adam Hassler, standing on the outskirts with Teresa and Ben. Ethan was struck with a single terrifying thought. "I'm losing my wife." He made a slow turn, studying all the faces. The grief was overpowering, a living thing. "I don't know what to say. Words can't make any of this feel better. We lost 3/4 of our people, and it's going to be hard for a long, long time. Let's do what we can to help one another, because it's just us out here, alone in the world." As everyone began to lift the bodies gently down into their graves, Ethan headed back across the field, through the falling snow toward Kate. He helped her lower Harold into his grave. Then they took up their shovels and, along with everyone else, began to fill in the dirt. Teresa. She walked with Hassler through the forest south of town, snowflakes drifting down between the pines. Adam had shaved his beard and cut his hair, but the smooth skin only underscored the gaunt, drawn quality of his face. He looked emaciated, like a refugee of a starving world. She couldn't get past how surreal it felt to be physically close to him again. Before she'd given him up for dead, she'd made it a habit of imagining their reunion. None of those fantasies had been anything like the real thing.
"Are you sleeping all right?" Teresa asked.
"It's funny. You don't know how many nights out in the wild I dreamed of sleeping in a bed again. All the pillows, the covers, the warmth, the safety. Being able to reach out in the dark to a bedside table and wrap my hand around a cool glass of water. But since I've been back, I've barely slept. Guess I got used to sleeping in a bivy sack tied into a tree 30 feet off the ground. How about you?"
"It's difficult," she said.
"Nightmares?"
"I keep dreaming that things went another way. That those Abbeys got into the jail cell."
"How's Ben?"
"He's okay. I can tell he's trying to wrap his head around what happened. A lot of his classmates didn't make it."
"He saw things no kid should ever have to see."
"He's 12 now. Can you believe it?"
"He looks so much like you, Teresa. I've wanted to see more of him, to just talk to him, but it didn't feel right. Not yet."
"That's probably best," she said.
"Where's Ethan?"
"He was going to stay with Kate for a while after the burial."
"Some things never change, huh?"
"She lost her husband. She doesn't really have anyone else." Teresa sighed. "I told Ethan."
"Told him?"
"About us."
"Oh."
"I didn't have a choice. I couldn't just go on keeping it from him."
"How'd he take it?"
"You know Ethan. How do you think?"
"But he understands what the situation was, right? That you and I were trapped here. That we thought he was dead."
"I explained everything."
"So does he not believe you?"
"I don't know if it's that so much as he's just trying to come to terms with the idea that, well, you know."
"That I was fucking his wife."
Teresa stopped. "So quiet in the woods."
"It was good, right?" Hassler asked. "When it was just you, me, and Ben, I made you happy, didn't I?"
"Very."
"You have no idea what I'd do for you, Teresa."
She looked up into his eyes. He stared at her with such love. An energy in the air, Teresa could sense that this moment carried more heft than she realized. Her heart had once been wide open to this man, and if she let him keep looking at her like this, like she was the only thing that existed in this world... He moved in, kissed her. At first, she drew back. Then she let him. Then she kissed back. He walked her slowly back against a pine tree, and as he pressed into her, she ran her fingers through his hair. As he kissed her neck, her head tilted back, and she looked up into snowflakes falling and melting on her face, and then he was unzipping her jacket, his fingers making quick work of the buttons on her shirt underneath, and she found herself reaching for his. She stopped.
"What?"
he asked, breathless.
"What's wrong?"
"I'm still married."
That didn't stop him.
There was a part of her that wanted him to talk her into it, to keep pushing, to not stop.
"Remember how he made you feel? What was it you said to me, Teresa? Your love for him always burned at a hotter temperature?"
"I've seen him change in the last month. I've seen glimmers of..."
"Glimmers? Is that all you felt for me? Glimmers?"
She shook her head.
"I love you with everything I have. Nothing held back. No bets hedged. All in. Every second of every day."
Off in the distance, a scream ripped through the forest. An Abbey. High-pitched, delicate, blood-curdling. Hassler staggered back away from her, and she could see the intensity hardening across his brow.
"I don't think it's inside the fence," he said.
"Let's get out of here anyway," she said. She buttoned up, zipped up. They started back toward town. Her body was humming, and her head was spinning. They reached the road and walked down the double yellow line. Buildings appeared in the distance. In silence, they headed into Wayward Pines. She felt reckless, but she went on with him. At the intersection of 6th and Main, Hassler said,
"Can we go see it together?"
"Sure." They walked down the sidewalk of their neighborhood. No one out. The house is empty and dark. Everything looked cold and gray and void of life.
"Doesn't smell like us in here anymore," he said as they stood at the foot of the stairs in what had once been their yellow Victorian.
He moved into the kitchen, through the dining room, and back out into the hallway.
"I can't imagine how difficult this is for you, Teresa."
"You have no idea." Hassler emerged out of the shadow of the hall, and when he reached her, he went down on one knee.
"I think this is how it's done, right?" he asked.
"What are you doing, Adam?"
He took her hand. His were rough, not the hands she remembered. They'd become wiry and hard as steel, and there was dirt from beyond the fence embedded so deep underneath his fingernails she couldn't imagine it ever washing away.
"Be with me, Teresa, whatever that means in this new world we're living in."
Tears dripped off her chin onto the floor. Her voice trembled. She said,
"I'm already—"
"I know you're married. I know Ethan's here, but I don't give a shit, and you shouldn't either. Life is too hard and too short not to be with the one you love. So choose me."
9. Ethan. Francis Levin lived in a standalone structure in a far corner of the Ark, built into an overhang in the rock wall. Ethan's keycard didn't work on the reader, so he banged his fist against the steel door instead.
"Mr. Levin!"
After a moment, the lock retracted. The door cracked open. The man who answered stood barely 5 feet tall, and he was dressed in a bathrobe, which filth and time had degraded to something less than white. 45 or 50, Ethan guessed, although Levin's advanced state of dishevelment made that approximation iffy. His dishwater hair was shoulder-length and shiny with grease, and through large blue eyes he regarded Ethan with unveiled suspicion that bordered on malice.
"What do you want?"
Levin asked.
"I need to talk to you."
"I'm busy. Another time."
Levin tried to shut the door, but Ethan shoved it open hard and forced his way inside. Candy bar wrappers littered the floor, and the air carried a moist, moldy scent, like the living space of a 16-year-old boy, but spiked with the caustic odor of stale coffee. The sole illumination came from recessed lighting in the ceiling, and the glow of the giant LED displays that covered almost every square foot of wall space. Ethan stared at the one closest to him, which showed a digital pie chart. At a glance, the chart appeared to reflect the atmospheric breakdown of the superstructure's air content. He didn't know what to make of all the screens. They showed a seemingly incomprehensible array of data. Sets of temperature gradients in Kelvin, a digital representation of what Ethan assumed were the 1,000 suspension chambers. Vital stats on the 250 people still warm and breathing on the planet. Drone footage. A full biometric readout on the female Abby in captivity. It was like the surveillance center on steroids.
"I would like for you to leave," Levin said. "No one bothers me here."
"Pilcher's finished. In case you didn't get the memo, you work for me now."
"That's debatable."
"What is this place?"
Levin glared him down through a thick pair of glasses. Stubborn, resisting. Ethan said,
"I'm not leaving."
"I monitor the systems that keep the superstructure and Wayward Pines functioning. We call it Mission Control."
"Which systems?"
"All of them. Electrical, hull, filtration, surveillance, suspension, ventilation, the reactor underneath us that powers everything."
Ethan moved deeper into the nerve center.
"And it's just you responsible for all of this?"
Levin let slip a smirk.
"I have minions. You know, in the event I'm hit by the proverbial bus."
Ethan smiled, detecting the first inkling of a wicked sense of humor.
"I hear you keep to yourself," Ethan said.
I'm in charge of the engine that makes our existence possible. I work 18 hours a day, every day. Before the burial this morning, I hadn't seen the sky in 3 years.
Doesn't sound like much of a life.
Well, it's the one I have. I happen to love it.
Ethan approached a set of monitors in a dark alcove that streamed lines of code at the speed of a stock market ticker.
What's this? Ethan asked.
Beautiful, isn't it?
I'm running some projections.
Projections on. Levin came and stood beside him. They watched the lines of code spilling down the screens like a waterfall. Levin said finally,
"The viability of what remains of our species. See, things were dire long before David had his little temper tantrum and threw his people to the wolves."
"Dire how?"
"Follow."
Levin showed Ethan over to the main console, where they sat down in oversized leather chairs facing an expensive array of screens.
"Before the massacre in the valley, there were 160 souls living in the mountain," Levin said. 461 living in Wayward Pines. Our data only goes back 14 years, but the first killing freeze typically comes in late August. You haven't been here for a winter yet, but they're long and brutal. The snow can get 10, 15 feet deep in the valley. There's no garden to harvest from, no fruit, no vegetables. We subsist solely on our reserve of freeze-dried meals, supplements, and meat rations. You want to hear a dirty little secret?
Now that this is all on you?
David Pilcher never intended for us to stay in this valley indefinitely.
What are you talking about?
He miscalculated how uninhabitable and hostile this world would become.
Ethan felt something go dark inside of him.
I'm rerunning my calculations, Levin said, but it's looking like our winter rations will run out in 4.2 years. Now, there are things we can do to delay the inevitable, like enforcing reduced rations, but that only buys us, at most, another year or two.
Not to be callous, but don't we have less mouths to feed now?
Yes, but the Abbeys wiped out our cattle, our dairy. There will be no milk, no meat. It would take years to reboot the herd.
Then we have to find a way to store what we grow for the winter.
Our current setup in town doesn't produce enough food to feed us and save for the future.
You mean we eat what we grow?
Exactly. And pretty much right now, we're just too far north. 2,000 years ago, we might have been able to make this growing season work, but it's gotten shorter and harsher. And these last few years have been the coldest yet. Here's what I wanted to show you.
Levin input some new code via the touchscreen. A list began to scroll. Ethan examined the monitor above him. Rice, 17%. Flour, 6%. Sugar, 11%. Grain, 3%. Iodized salt, 32%. Corn, 0%. Vitamin C, 55%. Soybeans, 0%. Powdered milk, 0%. Malt, 4%. Barley, 3%. Yeast, 1%. The list continued on. Ethan said,
"These are the reserve staple levels?"
"Yes, and as you can see, it's critical."
What was Pilcher planning to do?
With our full in-town population, we might have had the manpower to expand our gardens fast enough to meet demand. We were also looking into building a network of greenhouses, but see, the problem comes with snow loads in the winter. If enough weight were to build up on the glass roofs, they'd collapse. Again, we're just too far north.
Do the people in the mountain understand what's coming?
No. David didn't want to spook anyone until we had come up with a solution.
And you haven't.
There isn't one, Levin said. 5-year models confirm this valley will become uninhabitable. If we catch a really bad winter, possibly sooner.
We're all from the modern age. If push came to shove, we might have been able to adopt an agrarian lifestyle in a more temperate climate. But with weather like this, the only lifestyle that might support us is the nomadic hunter-gatherer.
Except we're trapped in this valley.
Precisely.
What about the Abbeys? Ethan asked.
As a food source?
Yeah.
First off, gross. Secondly, we've run models, and there's too much inherent danger in venturing out beyond the fence to kill them. If we did that on a regular basis, we'd lose too many of our own. Look, I get that you're just finding this out now, but trust me, I've been grappling with this problem for 3 years. There was no solution before, there's even less of one now.
Did you know what David was planning?
You mean with killing the power to the fence?
Yeah.
No, I was sitting right here the night the fence went down. I called him. He wouldn't answer. He did it from his office, and he locked me out of the system.
So he didn't consult with you beforehand?
David and I haven't been on the greatest of terms these last few years.
Why's that?
Levin pushed his chair back from the console and rolled across the floor.
The David Pilcher you know wasn't the same man who hired me away from Lockheed Martin. The end of Wayward Pines has been coming for a long time, but David didn't want to face it. It's arrogance, I think, a refusal to admit that he missed this potential crisis, that he didn't foresee it and steer us all out of the way. Recently, he's become increasingly withdrawn, erratic, emotional. He killed his own daughter. That was the first major fracture. Then when you took control of the town and told the residents the truth, I think he just couldn't deal anymore, said screw this and hit self-destruct.
So you're telling me it's over? We're all going to starve to death?
Levin smiled. If the Abbeys don't get us first. Ethan rose to his feet, watched the monitor scroll the list of depleted provisions like the writings of a doomsday prophet. He said,
"You've got access to every database in the structure?"
"That is correct."
"Did you know a nomad just returned? Adam Hassler?"
"I heard rumblings of it."
"Do you have access to his file here?"
Levin tilted his head.
"I don't really feel too hot about where this conversation is going."
"I want you to pull his file."
"Why?"
"Before Wayward Pines, Hassler and I used to work together. He was my supervisor in the Secret Service, and the one who sent me here. I had no idea he was here until I saw him on the street a couple days ago. Come to find out, before Pilcher brought me out of suspension, Hassler was living here, and I don't think it's a coincidence. Something doesn't feel right."
Levin scooted back to the console array and went to work on the touch screens.
"And what is it exactly you'd like to know?" he asked.
Hassler's face appeared on the monitor, his eyes closed, skin pale, a post-suspension photo.
"How he came to be here."
"Oh."
Levin quit typing, spun around in his chair.
"I don't think I'm going to have that level of detail. You'll have to ask Pilcher himself."
Ethan stepped inside the cage, found David Pilcher eating his supper, some freeze-dried abomination from the winter reserves. The old man looked even older, with the beginnings of a white beard fading in across his face, and as Ethan sat down across from him in the cramped cell, he wondered just how much rage simmered underneath the surface. Ethan had plenty of his own. He couldn't drive the image of those grieving families out of his mind, the sound of those shovel heads spearing into dirt. All that pain, this one man's doing.
"That does not smell like Tim's cooking," Ethan said.
Pilcher glanced up, hard, indignant, defiant.
"It's like Satan shit on a plate. Must give you great pleasure."
"What?"
"Seeing me like this, relegated to a cage that was built to hold a monster?"
"I'd say it's serving its purpose perfectly."
"Thought you'd forgotten about me down here, Ethan."
"No, just been busy cleaning up the mess you made."
"The mess I made?"
Pilcher laughed.
"Adam Hassler. What about him?"
"I hear that before I was brought out of suspension, Adam lived with my wife and son.
As I recall, they were quite happy, too."
"How did Adam Hassler come to be a resident of Wayward Pines?"
A touch of life crinkled in the corners of Pilcher's eyes.
"What does it matter now?" he asked.
"You do not want to fuck with me."
Pilcher set his plate aside. Ethan said, I'm told that he came here looking for me after my disappearance, and that you abducted him. That he woke up here, just like I